Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It will not be the end of the world if we're all driving great Chinese EVs that cost $27,000 a year, but it'll break my heart.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Patrick George, Editor-in-Chief of Inside EVs.
And I'm Tim Levin, Senior Reporter at Inside EVs. This week, we're talking about a breakthrough in solid-state batteries and new details on the EREV boom. Plus, stick around for our conversation with political strategist Mike Murphy, all about how EVs got politicized and how to change that. How's it going, man? How are you doing?
You know, I'm hanging in there, Tim. You know, I remember at the beginning of this year, we were all kind of predicting, oh, it's going to be a slower year on the EV front. You know, especially with like President Trump coming in and he might take away the tax credits. We might see slower growth. You know, we might see some automakers back off, until the battery costs get down. And then this EV race picks up for real at the end of this decade. When does the slower year happen? Do you know? Have you seen it yet? Because I feel like every day for us is like spray and pray lately. So whenever that wants to kick off, I welcome it. You know, how about you, man? Staying busy, I'm sure.
Yeah, things are good. I have not felt the so-called the mythical EV slowdown yet. It's been pretty crazy. We were just talking off camera about how, like, I feel like in the podcast I listen to, the banter is always much more interesting than our lives. You know, we're both big fans of Pivot, and both of those hosts are always like gallivanting around the world and skiing in Aspen with world leaders and presidents and stuff. And my life is just not that interesting. So I think we're gonna have to work on that for phase two of the Plug-In Podcast.
Yeah, phase two involves me like talking about, as you said, like inviting the Obamas to my chalet in Switzerland. I've not had that experience in podcasting quite yet, but who knows? You know, 26 could be our year, Tim. I think we're staying busy, but I what's been interesting for me just has how much this last week has proven that the stuff that we write about, the sort of moves to electrification in the auto industry, this is really not slowing down. It's not the way that people expected, whether it's hybrids, a lot more hybrid options coming out, plug-in and the regular kind, a lot more really innovative battery technologies that we're going to talk about today. You know, we're going to dive into some of it, but also Volvo had some really big EV news that we're not even going to be able to touch on this time. They have a new sedan coming out with 430 miles of range, and it'll add 200 miles in like 20 minutes. Kia's got some really great stuff coming out that you will read about on InsideEVs.com by the time this podcast has dropped. So yeah, just a general, like, it, a lot is happening right now, and there's a lot to be really excited about on this front if you're a new car shopper in the next few years and you don't love paying for gasoline.
Yeah, and I think some of the biggest news this week came from Mercedes. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, no, this is really, really exciting. So for years now, car companies have been chasing what's called sometimes the holy grail of battery technologies, which is called solid-state batteries. And Mercedes says that they are the first automaker to have an actual prototype on the road running solid-state batteries. And if you're not a chemistry expert, like me and Tim Levin definitely are, let me explain why that's a big deal. Solid state batteries use what's called a solid electrolyte instead of a liquid one like you would find in almost all lithium ion batteries. And if this technology takes off, you will eliminate most, if not all, of the drawbacks to electric vehicles. We're talking less risk of fires, more range, faster charging, lighter weight. I mean, this would, in theory, take care of everything. And this Mercedes solid-state battery prototype, they shoved this battery into an EQS sedan, and it's supposed to get 620 miles of range. Now, this thing isn't for sale yet, right? It's still a prototype. It's still testing it. And as we're going to talk about in a second, a lot of automakers are chasing this technology. But like, you know, Mercedes has been a little bit slower to the EV race. They haven't had as much success, I think, as BMW, it's fair to say. And now they're like, boom, like we're working on some really game changer technology. And I think it's fitting it would debut on something like an S-Class. I mean, what you want to elaborate more on what these cells are and where they're coming from?
Yeah. Mercedes got these cells from a U.S. startup called Factorial Energy. If you're curious about how they work, they have a lithium metal anode, which is kind of one of the avenues to solid state batteries. Mercedes says that these batteries can have 25% more range than a traditional lithium ion cell of the same size. And like you said, that's a big deal because basically the problem with batteries so far has been how do you take a certain amount of weight, a certain amount of battery size, and put more energy into it? Because weight, you know, reducing weight is a big deal for getting more range, and solid state batteries promise to solve a lot of those issues.
Yeah. And, you know, just, I love the idea that you can get around things like, you know, temperature affecting your range. You know, having lived with an EV through an upstate New York winter, like it's fine. It's surmountable for me, like having, you know, my Kia's range get cut by like a third. But it's like not great. And when you think about what it would take for mass adoption for this stuff to work for everybody, it's way faster charging. It's not having problems in the winter. It's certainly getting rid of those pesky fires, which, you know, are statistically much rarer than gasoline fires. But when they do happen, it's a bad day for any fire department. So this is a really exciting technology. There are some caveats here, which is that we've seen prototypes of this before. Toyota, my young writer Suvrat Kotari reminded me over lunch the other day, they actually had a prototype of this thing in this kind of space-agey looking concept in 2021. That didn't really go anywhere. They've not really done anything with it since, but Toyota specifically has been researching solid-state batteries since about the 90s, and a bunch of other automakers are chasing it too. That's why it's called the Holy Grail, right? Like everybody's been trying to crack this code for decades now, and whoever figures this out first and can make it at a decent price and scale it, I think they're really going to have like a takeoff moment for EVs like we've never seen before.
Yeah, and besides the companies we've talked about, you know, a lot of automakers are hitching their wagon to this, or at least making bets on it. Hyundai's in it, BMW, Honda, and then there's a bunch of startups. I think the one that people are probably might be most familiar with is QuantumScape, which is a battery startup here in the U.S. that's backed by Bill Gates. So yeah, the thing is, like, this has been something that it's kind of like nuclear fusion. It's always a couple of years away. You know, it's one of those things that could be game changing, but people have been working on it for a long time and it's never really seen the light of day outside of the lab, which is why this Mercedes is a really big deal. Like we don't really know when this kind of technology will actually make it into an EQS. But it won't be next year. A lot of these companies are talking about, you know, end of the decade is when we might start to see solid state batteries in actual cars.
Yeah.
And like, to play devil's advocate here, it's not like you make a solid state battery, you put it in a car, and all problems are solved. You still need to scale up this technology. It's a whole new type of production process. You need to build factories.
Yeah.
You need to make it cost competitive. And that's tough when we've been making lithium-ion batteries in basically the same way for decades. And plus, I mean, the other thing I'd mention is, like, the whole time that Toyota and these other companies have been working on solid-state, regular lithium-ion batteries have gotten a lot better over time. There's a lot of advancements that automakers and battery companies have made just within the standard framework of a battery that has made them longer range and more energy-dense and faster charging and all the things that we really need for EVs to take off. So, you know, Holy Grail, sure. I think there's a lot to be said also for kind of incremental improvements, just making batteries better. I mean, you know, your Kia, right? This thing can charge super fast. We already have the Hyundai Ioniq 6 is the fastest charging EV you can buy right now, according to Edmunds. And this thing can add 100 miles of range in less than 7 minutes. Like, that's not a solid state battery. That's a regular ass battery. So
yeah,
I think there's a lot that can be done with non-solid state too.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm going back to something that, another journalist who's been in this space longer than I have told me last year. It's like, we've spent 100 years, more than that, developing internal combustion engines. In terms of like time and R&D and money, like we've barely scratched the surface on like automotive grade batteries. Like that is just such a black box still. But the amount of money going into that, the research going into that is, you know, unprecedented at the moment. Like it's like we haven't begun to see what we're going to get in the next few years. I think a lot of people judge electric vehicles and hybrids even by where they're at now. And, you know, it's rather than think like, okay, think about where this can go. Like, there's some amazing options out here, but like every year we see stuff that just does technological quantum leaps over what we used to cover with gas cars. I mean, think about where it's going, right? Like that's what I find really exciting about this space. And why I'm excited to cover it so often. So, you know, it's like, just remember 10 years ago, it was like, what are your options? Like a Tesla Model S or like, if you lived in California, like that electric Ford Focus that, you know, went like, could go around, like it could go like 3 blocks before it died. Like that was 10 years ago. Imagine what we'd be doing 5 from now or 10 from now. So, yeah, man, exciting stuff, you know?
Yeah. What do you think? So as somebody who covered the kind of general auto industry and gas car stuff for longer than I did, when do you think that we kind of plateaued in terms of gas engine, like technology, you know? I think this is something where, like you're saying, EVs have gotten so much better just in the kind of modern era. Whereas, as far as I can tell, like gas advancements ended with like, I don't know, fuel injection and turbochargers or whatever. Like it's been the same for a long time.
It's yeah, right. That's a great point. And it's like, I remember like when I was a kid, like reading every car magazine I could get my hands on in the 90s, like a fast car that back then was like 300 horsepower. 300 horsepower is like table stakes now. That's you could buy a Toyota Camry like today with that much or close to it. And it just like seemed like for years in the 2000s and the 2010s, like we just had this arms race of horsepower until you had these, you know, Dodge Chargers and Dodge Challengers with 1,000 horsepower, you know, these crazy gas cars in the, like the hybrid hypercars. But the last few years, it does feel to me like it's plateaued a bit. Like, I do think we've sort of started hitting a wall in terms of performance with gas cars and also what people can handle, you know, because like now you're selling really high test Corvettes to like, no offense to anyone listening, like baby boomers who necessarily can't maybe not handle all of that speed. You know what I mean? Like really crazy stuff. So it's, I think it is kind of hitting a wall a little bit. And where do you go with internal combustion next? If you're trying to make it better and better, it's like, it's efficiency. So you're probably making these engines smaller, honestly. And I don't know how appealing that is to everybody. Like I kind of look at like the new Dodge Charger that's coming out, that's got like a turbo inline 6 in it. And I just, as an enthusiast, I'm like, you know, like, right. Like if I want a BMW, I'd buy a BMW. Like, it's like, give me the Hemi or go home, or give me this EV powered one. That's probably faster and better. So like, I do see electrification as like the next great frontier in performance for gas cars. And if you're not going that route, if you're not going to that all EV eventually, like you're kind of relying on 20th century technology that's, I think, is starting to hit a wall a little bit. So thank you for coming to my TED talk.
Yeah, it's why we've seen, not just in the last couple of years, you know, in this kind of century, all the most high performance, craziest supercars, and even regular consumer cars are either full blown EV or some kind of hybrid, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I remember like last summer, I had a Kia EV6 GT, which is like a very practical crossover. It's the faster version of the car I have. And like, you know, you put all your stuff in it, put your kids in it, put car seats in it, and like you could dust a Lamborghini in that thing. It's almost made performance 0 to 60 times irrelevant. I think that when we're talking about stuff like solid state batteries, you talk about weight reduction, right? That's what I'm excited about, because I don't think these heavy batteries work well for pickup trucks, and they definitely don't work well for sports cars, which I would like to see somebody figure out a decent, lightweight, engaging electric sports car at some point in my life. But you know, we're getting past those barriers very quickly. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It moves a hell of a lot faster than, you know, you wait 4 years and oh, here's the mid-cycle update to our car and it has 10 more horsepower and we changed that, we gave you a volume knob back and now it's like, oh no, these things are dramatically different after a few years than they used to be.
Yep. Thanks for bringing us back around to batteries.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk about something different. We have some news from Ram and Scout that's very different than I think most people are used to. You want to talk about what's going on the EREV scene?
Yeah, so this week we learned a bunch of new stuff about two of the coolest new electrified vehicles that are coming soon, at least to our minds. The Ram 1500 Ram Charger and then the Scout trucks, which are a part of Volkswagen. Some of it got us pumped about the coming boom of extended range EVs, and some of it not so much, to be honest. As a refresher, these are both EREVs, which basically are EVs with gas generators that help them go farther, but that gas engine doesn't actually power the wheels at all.
Yeah. We'll start with the Scout. If you don't know what Scout is, I think you've been living under a rock the last year, but that's the new revived American iconic classic truck and SUV brand. It's being brought back to life by the Volkswagen Group as an EV and as an extended range electric vehicle. Yeah, they look really great too, but you know, Scott Keogh, who is the CEO of Scout, went on Jay Leno's Garage, which, by the way, Jay Leno lately has like a shockingly high batting average for like breaking news in this space. Like Tesla's been on there; they had some news out of that. Now Scout, they're dropping new details. So like, you know, I guess Jay is like the new Car and Driver or something. Like he's where you go to get all your news.
He's like the one outlet that Tesla trusts. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, they don't talk to us, they talk to Jay Leno.
I love that guy. He's such a charming, affable human being. He's like, I had a long career TV and now I'm just gonna like drive cars and make cool videos about it. And like he's like a very decent and kind human being and he's living the dream. So anyway, back to Scout. What Scott Keogh, CEO, announces that interestingly the two Scout models, they're going to use different battery types. The EV is going to use, you know, your standard nickel manganese cobalt battery packs, and the EREV is going to use a lithium iron phosphate battery pack. And that's also like the engine that recharges that battery. You know, they've said it's going to be just a naturally aspirated Volkswagen Group four cylinder. I won't go into too much detail here, but the types of batteries that are going to be on the EREV Scout, that's that they're cheaper to make. They are more durable. They're kind of the workhorse of the battery world. They tend to not have as good range, although that's changing fast. But it's like for this application, you kind of don't need to. And Scout has said that like there's just a ton of interest in the EREV. Like people want the EREV. They want the EV with the gas engine.
Yeah, and I just butt in to say that when you hear people talking about LFP batteries and how these are the cheaper type of battery, that's lithium iron phosphate.
So that's one. And then the other one is the Ram 1500 Ram Charger, or Ram Charger, if you want to abbreviate its name. This thing's really interesting. It's a Ram 1500 truck, but it's an EREV underneath. So EV battery, gas engine up front, 3.6 liter V6 out of the Stellantis parts bin. But all that engine does is recharge the battery. And it does some pretty clever stuff, honestly. We learned it has a bunch of different drive modes, including e-save mode. And it'll always keep your battery at about 50%. So it's like you're driving along, you don't want to lose all your range. You like that you're keeping it around 50, right? And it'll just, the gas engine will always act as a generator to keep it at that level. That's really clever. We also learned that it has a decently sized 92 kilowatt hour battery pack, but only 70 kilowatt hours of that is useful. So like almost a third, right? Like I'm bad at math, Tim, help me out. It's about a third. Third-ish, yeah, ish, sort of.
Don't test me here.
I know, we're journalists for a reason and not engineers. But anyway, yeah, so let's say about a third. It's not usable, but they kind of keep that in reserve for towing. And it's like, okay, most of the time you'll be using 70 kilowatt hours of this 92 battery pack. But if you need that extra juice, you know, you need that extra state of charge for when you're hauling your boat to the lake, or when, you know, you're driving your Airstream to your chalet in Switzerland, as I often do, it'll give you a little extra juice there to get done what you need to get done, which I think is a really interesting application for this that we haven't seen elsewhere. But it's got some weird drawbacks too. You want to go into those?
Yeah. First I'll just explain that the fact that you have a bunch of non-usable battery is basically because, as EV drivers will know too, when you get to a low state of charge, you lose some capability, you lose some power. And so they want to retain that for when you're towing or whatever. And they want some buffer so that, in those situations when just your engine is working, you're not just like at a 0% state of battery charge and that engine is trying to keep up and deliver electricity to the motors. And the other quick thing, the eSave mode, if you're below 50% and you turn it on, it'll bring you back up to 50%. If you're above 50%, like let's say you're at 80, you just want to maintain battery level at 80. That's what it'll do. You're at 80%. You want to maintain that, you hit eSave, and then you're driving and you're just getting energy from the generator, and you're leaving your battery alone. So just to clarify there. Yeah, the interesting thing here, and like you said, the Ramcharger is really interesting, and it's going to be really, really cool to see if people actually want to buy this thing, how it works in the real world. One of the big problems, one of the things that kind of made me scratch my head about EREVs in general was we learned that the Ramcharger is targeting 20.5 miles per gallon when you are using the gas mode, so when you're not on EV, and that is not very good for a vehicle that's supposed to be an electric or electrified truck. It's about the same as like the regular hybrid Ram 1500, F-150, right. Toyota Tundra. So it seems like in gas mode, you don't really get any benefit to fuel efficiency by being an EREV. And I mean, it makes sense because at that point, it's basically a truck with an engine, but also carrying around a 92 kilowatt hour big heavy battery pack. So it stands to reason that you're going to lose some efficiency there. But it really means that if you buy this thing and you just are doing it to get like a tax credit and you just run it in gas mode all the time, you're basically not getting any of the environmental or, cost benefits of owning an EREV. People really need to plug these things in to get the full benefit.
We're not sure they're going to either. It's right. Like we've done some stories about that. It's like EREVs are like plug-in hybrids, right? This is a new technology you have to explain to people. I honestly wager it's a little more complicated than owning an electric vehicle. Are people going to get the home equipment? Are they going to plug it in? Are they going to know how to use it? Are the dealers, the salespeople going to teach them how to do this stuff? We don't know yet. We're going to see how this works. I think you brought up an interesting point when you mentioned the F-150, Ford F-150 hybrid, which is selling really well right now. And part of me thinks like maybe that's just the way to go for pickup trucks and like big SUVs. It's like if people aren't really going to plug them in, if that's not their vibe, if the concept of an EREV is too complicated to execute, too complicated to explain to people, maybe we just make all the trucks hybrid, right? That's a lot less gas. It's a lot less emissions. You have a towing advantage for sure with that electric power. Part of me thinks maybe that's the way to go, but I am excited to see where Ram and parent company Stellantis go with this technology. So it's going to be a real interesting one to see if folks warm up to it too.
Yeah, and I'm not being totally fair when I mention that 20.5 miles per gallon, because in reality that's probably not how everybody will use it. You get huge benefits by having a EV, component that gets, 140, 150 miles of range. So like in total, in sum, if you're using that EV component for like most of the time when you're going to the grocery store or whatever, at the end of the day, you're going to end up with a gas efficiency that's way better than 20 miles per gallon. You're going to be using a lot less fuel and a lot less energy. And there's good reason, I think, to believe that like with PHEVs, it's been a big problem. We don't really know how much people plug them in. We guess that it's not a ton. It's not every single day or every single owner. But it kind of stands to reason that if you have an EREV and you have 100 plus miles of range, you're going to be more likely to plug that thing in and actually use it as an EV versus like if you have your Toyota RAV4 Prime and it gets like 30 miles of range, you're like, ah, screw it. Like, I don't even care. I'm just going to drive this thing like a hybrid. So, yeah, we'll have to see. But
yeah, this is the space on EVs we're still figuring out, right? Like we can make hyper efficient sedans all day, but that's, you know, people need like cars and trucks that can do everything, and we're not there yet. So it's gonna be real spicy to see that one.
All right, with that, should we get to this week's interview?
Yes, for sure. I think I'll start off before we introduce our next guest and just say that for any of this to take off the way that gets me and Tim excited, we think that EVs in America and electrified vehicles in general have to get past a kind of political hurdle right now, a kind of the way that they're viewed through this extreme partisan lens. Our next guest is going to be somebody who's worked in Republican politics for a long time, and he has a lot of great ideas on how we can get politics out of EVs.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
All right, our guest today on the Plugged In podcast, Mike Murphy, is a veteran Republican strategist who has advised politicians like John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now he runs the American EV Jobs Alliance and evpolitics.org, which are working to depoliticize electric vehicles. I can't think of a better guest to help us understand this particular moment. Mike Murphy, welcome to the show.
Well, hey, guys, it's great to be here. I'm a listener. I love the podcast, and I love Inside EV, so it's my favorite thing to do right here, gab about electric vehicles.
Yeah, man, absolutely. You've had a very interesting run, certainly over the last 12 months in particular. But before we get to where we're at now, would you tell us a little about your path and your career in politics and how you got to being in the EV space and with what you did before?
Absolutely. This is kind of a passion project for me. So I've been around Republican politics as a political consultant for, let's just say, a Jurassic amount of time. ran a bunch of campaigns on message, media, and strategy. Everybody from Arnold Schwarzenegger to a lot of the Republican governors, John Engler in Michigan, Jeb Bush in Florida, Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, worked on a bunch of presidential campaigns for the Bushes. I ran John McCain's campaign in 2000, the famous Straight Talk Express. So Had a pretty big career in that world, did a fair amount of corporate work too. But I am from Detroit, Michigan, and I'm a car nut, and I grew up around the car business. So I will confess now that my lifetime average is about 4 miles per gallon. I used to wrench on a lot of V8s. But when I moved to California to run Schwarzenegger, I met my wife and I stayed here. And as we started charging minibar prices for gasoline, where you can $6.50 a gallon, I got more and more interested in EVs, and even though I was originally kind of a harumpher, like a lot of real motorhead type folks are, the elegance of the electric powertrain is a pretty damn hard thing to beat. You know, very few moving parts, a lot of reasons. And so I drove a few, and I love the acceleration. So I got an EV a couple of years ago and became a fanatic. And increasingly, as an old foreign policy wonk, that's what I went to school for out in Washington, D.C., very worried about China wiping out the American auto industry, which can definitely happen, you know. Yeah. So I wrote the check, breaking every law of consultant behavior, and started the American EV Jobs Alliance with a website called evpolitics.org way back at the end of 2003. And the first thing we did, I got my friend David Hill. He's an amazing Republican pollster. First guy I know to own a DeLorean. Then the DeLorean, excuse me, first guy I know to own a Tesla, and as a grad student, was the rock concert promoter who first brought the Rolling Stones to Alabama. So I figured, this is the right guy to team up with on a car caper. And so we did this poll for the first time, really. We looked at the new and used car market through the eyes of people's political identity. And Automotive News published a bunch of it. I think you guys did, too. We kind of got it out there. And the phone started ringing, including some of the big OEMs. So I was visiting some CEOs of auto companies here and in Germany, saying, you know, a lot of the marketing is wrong. The green marketing is a disaster. You know, why? They're green cars. Well, people are interested in climate change, which is about 58% of the U.S. electorate. They already know all about electric cars, and they like them. What they want to know about is cost, charging, all the vehicle attributes. On the Republican side, you got a bunch of people, and it doesn't align totally, but you have about 40% of the new car market as we define it, which is voters with a household income of $50,000 a year and up. That's who we poll. That just aren't on the climate change train, and they see the vehicles as political, and that gets in the way. Sell the attributes, not the damn green leaf on the car, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we, you know, parts of the auto industry have kind of embraced our work, and we've kind of expanded right now with the subsidies under dire threat. I was in a D.C. meeting today about it. It looks quite grim, actually, to make it a jobs fight like it ought to be. And so we've been moving our actual title into the forefront of our brand as the American EV Jobs Alliance. And we are about to, next week, launch a congressional action campaign where people who live in anywhere, including your readers, I hope, but if you live in a district where there's a lot of EV manufacturing investment, you're going to start getting texts from us if you're targeted. And you click one link and you go to a site that tells you a little bit about what's going on and gives you the option to instantly email or call your members of Congress. So we're about to whip up the old windmill there, because if we don't make this a jobs and U.S. versus China competitiveness issue in the districts, we're going to get killed in Congress and all the subsidies are going to go away.
So what I'm trying to understand, I guess, is you're concerned that if EV tax credits go away, that will threaten the EV factory investments, the battery investments, and jobs that are primarily in red and purple states. Is that an accurate assessment?
Right. Yeah, the math is the top 35 congressional districts for EV investment. There are 28 Republican districts and 7 Democratic, so they're mostly red. They represent about 200,000 jobs and growing, and about $167 billion of material. And nobody knows it. It was the best-kept secret of the presidential campaign. We have a report on evpolitics.org about Michigan, where the Trump and the Republican forces spent $30 million bashing EVs. Kamala Harris spent zero defending them. She lost. I've done a lot of campaigns in Michigan. You don't lose by being perceived as anti-auto industry. We even did a poll of the voters there 2 weeks before the election to see how much damage was done. By almost 2-1, Michigan voters in the auto state think electric vehicles are bad for Michigan's economy. That's what $30 million in attack advertising will do unanswered. So it is a big, complicated fight, but we're trying to target those districts because we want Joe Congressman to feel the heat from back home that I really don't want to lose that component plant or that assembly plant. And, you know, I don't speak for the Ford Motor Company or for Lucid or Rivian or GM or anybody, but I'm acquainted with a lot of the thinking. And if the subsidies go away, if what happens here is anything like what happened in Germany when they cut their subsidies, you're looking at a big drop. And a big drop means dropping shifts. And these big, ambitious plants, if the Trump guys were able to pull back the funding or kill market demand, there's no guarantee they're going to get built. You know, these massive plants like Blue Oval in Tennessee. So do I think it'll stop EVs? No, but it will slow them down. And the problem is over in China, you show up there and say, hey, Patrick, Tim, and I got together, and we're going to start an electric car company. They say, great. Well, can we have a big fat loan because we're not going to make any profit? Profit, schmoffit. We want, you know, capacity. Build it. Now, a lot of those companies will in time go bankrupt. But over time, we already know the Chinese products are very, very good, and they have a huge profit advantage because the Chinese Communist government has a plan to conquest the world auto markets. Not to make money, our companies and the European companies and the Korean companies, Japanese companies have to try to make a profit. And when you're in business, hard to compete with somebody with a government that tells them, go lose money, taking market share. So this is a huge national security issue. It's a huge jobs issue. And we just have to decide, do we want to be the UK in the 60s and wind up with British Leyland, you know, one-tenth the size of the old industry? Or do we want to let American companies or companies that manufacture in North America, do we want to let them compete? So guess what? We got to have a level playing field with the Chinese on subsidies, at least in the short term. In the long term, we should be able to get rid of all of them if we do our job, but not in the next couple of years.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of policies that, you know, there's uncertainty around, right? There's the $7,500 straight up purchase tax credit. There's the leasing credit. There are credits for manufacturing, for charging stations. What's your read? I mean, you mentioned that you had a rather grim meeting recently. Like, what's your prediction? What's your read on the risk to these policies? Is this American jobs argument going to work? Or are we looking at a future where probably a lot of this stuff is going away?
Well, right now, if you're a Republican member of Congress and you vote against the consumer credits, lease and purchase for EVs, you get a total pass from the voters. One third of Republican voters, and we poll a lot, you know, we're campaign people, so we start there and then try to move public opinion. One third of Republican voters, the people you care about if you're in a safe Republican district like almost all these guys are, they think the U.S. is the number one car producer in the world. Another third think we're number two behind Japan. Only a third understand the size of the Chinese market or Chinese production power. So there's no political cost right now. And what's going to happen is the whips are going to come to you, you know, Congressman Levin, and they're going to say, well, you want to cut Medicare? You want to cut Biden giveaway for liberal cars? I'll cut the Biden giveaway for liberal cars. Thought you'd say so. And if you say no, then next thing you know, you get a call from the White House political office. You know, the president is really looking forward to endorsing your primary opponent next year. I don't have a primary in voting. You will. So they have very big hammers, and there's no district pushback. A couple of them are quietly behind the scenes, these congressmen, saying, look, I don't want to lose that plant, but, you know, I talked to my local dealer. He says the company doesn't really want to make these electrics. It'll be fine. They don't like the electric mandate. You know, there is no political pain right now in bucking electric cars in most of those districts. Now, if you whip up a job scene, because there are a lot of jobs, a lot. You know, the new Rivian plant in Georgia that they have a loan to build, that's 9,000 manufacturing jobs. That's massively important. But if we don't whip up the trouble in the districts and create political pushback, it's going to be a steamroller. The tricky one, I'll finish with this, is pulling back the construction loans is tricky. But there's no doubt, and we're seeing this with the NEVI charging program, that you can throw a lot of monkey wrenches into things and slow them down and make them unworkable. And if you kill the consumer subsidies and it hurts demand, then you're building a plant that's not going to function. And in the car business, you don't run a plant at 85%, you're not making any money. You run a plant at 50%, you're bleeding cash.
Here's the disconnect that I don't understand, is that President Trump has talked about bringing jobs back to America, bringing manufacturing jobs back to America. You know, he may be hitting all automakers who do foreign production with the steepest tariffs we've ever seen, because he's like, just build them in America instead. Yet this is already happening with, you know, the IRA and the Biden administration's initiatives. Like, we are already building domestic car plants and battery plants and putting workers back to work here with these plans. No. So like, why it seems like there's a philosophy of like being against that merely because these are electric vehicles, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the problem is when the president was on the campaign trail beating the hell out of EVs during the election, at one of his speeches, he said, you know, the Chinese have won the electric car thing. It's over. So stop screwing with it. And I think, unfortunately, President Trump, on one hand, wants to build up a manufacturing. I'm a Trump critic, but I believe that's true. I think he wants that. On the other hand, I'm not sure he understands the world auto market. I don't think he understands that the U.S. is only 10% of world auto sales. Now, it's the most lucrative 10%, best market in the world, but it's 10%. So if BYD is cranking out 16 million cars a year worldwide, and you're the Ford Motor Company trying to compete with them, cranking out 3.5 million cars a year, just the economies of scale give them quite an advantage. So I think that's a problem. The other problem, the tariffs are, you know, bad. Everybody past freshman economics knows that tariffs in a big way are terrible. You can use them as a negotiating tool, which Trump tends to do. But, you know, there's this assumption. I talked to some people in the steel business, and they're like, what nobody understands is in the White House, apparently, is, okay, we put a 25% tax on Canadian and Mexican steel. So now here at my, say, auto assembly plant, a lot of steel, a lot of cost. The tariff, people who are for tariffs say, well, you're just going to pick up the call and call U.S. steel and buy it domestically. Well, yeah, except what's U.S. steel going to do to their prices the day of the tariff? They're going to, if the tariff's 25%, they're going to raise them by 24.5, you know, and grab the windfall profit and be very happy. But now there will be shortages. And it's not like you can stand up a steel mill in a year. It's a decade or more in the U.S. because permitting is so hard for industrial properties here.
Yeah.
One reason all the lithium refinery went to China. Good luck trying to actually build a lithium refinery here, at least until recently when we kind of woke up.
Plants take half a decade if you're lucky, you know?
Yeah, if you're lucky. And so it's not like there's great American-made steel you can have a day later at a cheaper price. No, same price. In fact, probably the same price as the tariff steel, and maybe even higher because now there's a shortage. And all of a sudden, if you're the sales manager at the steel plant in northern Indiana, and you, all the car companies start calling, and suddenly you're selling a third more steel at the same capacity, you're going to raise prices even more. So it is play school economics, and I wish President Trump, I think in his heart, is a friend of American manufacturing. But in his experience, is a real estate developer who does not understand manufacturing and the North American integrated supply line. I mean, I used to tease my Democratic friends during the Obama administration, my buddy Axelrod, you know, I do a podcast with, they'd roll out a photo op of President Obama talking about how he missed his old Chrysler 300. You know, he drives an American Chrysler 300. Well, actually, it's a Canadian Chrysler 300.
Yeah.
Things put
yeah.
together in Ontario, Canada.
Made of old Mercedes-Benz parts, yeah.
Right, right. So it is, the North American auto industry is very integrated. The world auto industry is very yeah. integrated. And I don't think President Trump really understands that. And what I'm encouraging people to do is make sure your lobbyists go to the White House with a beautiful picture book of all these new plants that are going to be built or under construction now that Trump can go cut ribbons at and claim all the shamelessly claim credit for in 18 months to 2 years. You know, there's a win here for Trump politically, but I don't think he understands it. What he knows is Republican primary voters have a political hostility to electric vehicles because it's become tribal. Democrats buy 5 times as many EVs last year than Republicans do. So if Republicans see them not as cars, but as dogma-signaling liberal mobiles, beating up on them as a Republican politician gets you applause. Yeah. And that's where Trump is right now, not seeing the bigger picture, and I think underestimating how important EVs are going to be in the world market in 15 years. So when he says the Chinese own EVs, what he's really saying is, goodbye American auto industry in 20 years. And, you know, that's unacceptable to me. And I'll tell you, anybody with more than, you know, 3 stripes on their shoulder at the Pentagon is going to tell you the same thing. I had an American auto CEO tell me, you know, in 15 years, if the Army calls me up and says we need 10,000 tanks, I'm going to tell them to call China. Because I don't know what's going to be left of our manufacturing capacity. We might take our plants overseas to survive.
I'd like to go back to something real quick about the tribalism you mentioned. In your research, like, where does that come from? That extreme sort of partisan view of a different type of powertrain for a car.
Yeah, you would think, you know.
Even a decade and a half into this mainstream era, like, where does that come from?
Well, I do a whole kind of PowerPoint, and it's been growing based on our polling, but it started with, remember, and you guys are in this space enough, Tim, you may be too young, but old farts like me and Patrick will remember, prickly me, I'm ancient. Remember the old Nissan white polar bear spot when they introduced the Leaf, the groundbreaking Leaf, to the U.S. market? Here, the spot won a lot of awards because it was very good advertising creative. It was absolutely terrible advertising strategy. So you're launching the Leaf, the first real mass market battery car from Nissan. And so the spot opens with a polar bear on an ice floe, having a good polar bear day, and looks up and watches a big part of the ice floe melt. So starts to swim, and goes across the world and winds up in any town USA in some guy's driveway. And the guy has a new Nissan Leaf. And the guy walks out, and they, well, is the polar bear going to kill him? No, the polar bear gives him a big hug. Thank you for buying a battery car. Mm-hmm. So it was all environmental virtue signaling.
Yeah.
And that started to frame these not as cars, but as statements about yourself. So when we poll people, like, for example, we ask people, do you have a favorable or neutral or mostly unfavorable opinion of Toyota? Republicans and Democrats have essentially the same opinion. They both love Toyota. Same thing with Volkswagen. Same thing with Ford. Every car brand. There's no one of the few things in politics we're not fighting about is everybody loves Ford. Everybody really loves Toyota, et cetera. All the famous brands do about the same. Then we say electric-only car brands, 50-point difference. Republicans go crazy negative. Democrats stay pretty positive, though not as positive. Elon Musk. We did a post-election survey, got a lot of press that we released. Among people who voted for Donald Trump, they give Elon a 70% favorable rating and a 10% unfavorable rating. 7-to-1 ratio. Very, very good. Almost as good as Trump's numbers among Republicans. Among people who voted for Harris, Elon's negative rating is 76%. That's like up with Hamas. 5% favorable. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The margin of error is 4%. So it's hard for me to statistically prove in all of America that there's a Harris voter who's favorable of Elon Musk. And this was done after the election. I'll bet it's worse now.
Yeah.
We ask people, are you interested in buying an EV in the next year or so? You know, the most likely buyers of the auto market. And among the 20% who said they were in that category, that they're really thinking about it, doesn't mean they will, but, you know, the closest to doing it. Among that 20%, Tesla is far less favorable as a brand than Toyota, Ford, and Volkswagen. We tested one German, one American on this survey, significantly less. In fact, I gave my spiel with all our polling data to the Society of Automotive Engineers meeting in D.C. a few weeks ago, a couple hundred auto engineers, and three guys from Toyota pulled me into a hallway. Can we get a copy of that polling? I go, yeah, if you guys ever made a decent EV, you'd crush with it.
Yes, we've as fair as we can be, we have basically said that message to Toyota's executives. Like, you know that if you wanted to make money, and as I understand it, that's the point of your company. Yes, you probably could make a lot of it here. And they're like, I don't know, maybe we don't. So, you know.
Yeah, the hybrid model has been great for their business. But anyway, what I say is that brand's right. The Tesla brand has real weight on it now from Elon. And it's going to only get worse. You can see it in the sales figures. So the partisanship came from the environmental definition. When we define these things on attributes, Republicans start coming back. And, you know, Elon could be Nixon to China. He could move the Republican numbers. There's some evidence in our Elon report, which is available to anybody to read at evpolitics.org, that he has helped the category a little, even though he hasn't really tried to, just by being Elon. But as far as who's going to buy a Tesla next week, he's been a nightmare for the brand, and he's costing them sales.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think has been his kind of net impact? You know, I guess the big question is, like, he turns off liberals nowadays. He brings in new right-wing, new Republican buyers, potentially. What do you think his total impact has been? Is it expanding the EV market to new people, or is it, you know, stunting it?
It's stunting it in the short term. So the buyers most likely to buy EVs in the near term, Elon is taking Tesla off the menu. Not destroying it totally. But he is a huge anchor around their neck. I like to joke that whoever the Tesla CEMO is probably sitting right now in a dark room with a bottle of whiskey and a revolver, you know, with a tear streaming down their eye, because it is a huge problem for them. On the other hand, they're already big, and the word of mouth, which is the best way to sell EVs, still on the vehicles is pretty good, and they're, you know, some of their product stuff's improving. But yeah, Elon is an anchor. In the longer term, categorically for EVs, Elon could help. I mean, he has the numbers to be Nixon to China and start telling Republicans it's okay to own an EV. He hasn't done that yet, but even by osmosis, there's some softening in some of the Republican attitudes. But that, you know, so on the 5-year plan, Elon might be doing some good even without trying. But on the make next quarter plan, he is a gift to every other EV maker in the market. And there's also more product competition now. Now, the problem is, I think Elon is a fan of J.P. Morgan and his famous quote. Morgan said, every businessman has only one true enemy, competition. And so if Elon can whack those consumer subsidies, the scenario for Elon is then the companies will sell fewer EVs, are going to have to buy more emissions credits, all profit from Elon. And, you know, now on the other hand, if Trump says, hey, Detroit, I just slaughtered all these EV credits because you're stupid. That's China. Why are you even doing it? Don't you understand the future is the buggy whip, et cetera? But I'm going to do you a favor, and I'm going to lighten up the mileage standards. That'll reduce demand for Elon's credit. So I have a feeling whatever influence the co-president has is going to go from murder the consumer credits to and murder the plant loans and murder the other charging networks that are not mine. But, you know, don't be lightening up on those mileage credits because that's the vice to sell the clean air credits that Tesla makes more money from than anything else in terms of sheer profit.
As a quick aside note, if you're new to this system and aren't thrilled by the regulatory credit system, it's that basically Tesla and other EV makers make money because other automakers buy credits for them to offset how much they pollute. And this is a pretty
and in Europe.
And in Europe, yes. And so this is a pretty
Tesla
sizable.
Tesla just sold like $3 billion in credits, all profit.
Yeah. It's a pretty sizable portion of Tesla's revenue. Personally, I've never had a problem with the system. There are some intense critics of it, but I kind of think, if that's the law, then use it. But anyway, that's how
I think
that
it's
works.
Okay until the largest, I'll be a political consultant, use loaded terms, the largest, and I'm actually okay with the credits too, but if I were attacking it, I would say the largest corporate welfare profiteer in America sends $200 million to help the president get selected so then he can screw a policy to satisfy the self-interest of the company he's a majority stockholder of. You know, it's pretty shoddy. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I think if it were to happen, the House budget thing is going to be tough and bumpy. But if they have to choose between cutting Medicaid, not giving back the big property tax deduction in what are called the SALT states, which helps you deduct your expense of local property taxes on your federal income tax, or bailing out Biden's electric bubble car program, I can tell you which one's heading for the crapper. Unless we start a big China jobs thing in these districts and peel off five or six congressmen. But right now, the resources being brought to that fight, this is a point I made in an industry meeting today, you guys are feathers against bowling balls here, spitballs against battleships. If the industry doesn't get serious, and by the way, some of the people on Capitol Hill, the lobbyist types, are complaining they're not getting CEOs to call congressmen. The industry is sleeping through this. And that puts them in a tough position because if there's not screams of pain coming out of the companies and people start talking about we may not build that plant or we may stop construction, there's going to be no political price. It's going to be a done deal. And the subsidies will go away. We didn't really talk about the NEVI stuff, but that's a problem too. Although I'm kind of a NEVI critic, you know. Am I shocked that here in California, the biggest, in L.A. County where I am, which I believe is pretty easily the largest EV market in North America, with over 20% penetration into a county with 10 million people in it, I drive every day on my way to office past a beautiful EV Go station with 10 brand new dispensers that has been there over 2 years, fenced off, and until recently, the weeds were taller than the equipment, which has never been commissioned. We don't have any NEVI stations in California, which is insane, that are operating. There are some in progress. On the other hand, Mike DeWine, the old school meat and potatoes Republican governor of Ohio, first guy in the country to get him, he and New York have done the best job. So and what Trump will do now is try, and there will be legal fights, to freeze the 700 or 800 stations in the pipeline. And even if they lose the legal fights, you got to remember, their political thugs don't fill certain jobs. The phone's ringing at the energy department to prove a grant that's already been approved and nobody's answering it or not returning emails. So they can kind of slow walk stuff or some dumb Repub governor. I'm telling you, I'll bet money you're going to get a press release from the governor of fill in the blank saying, well, I took all that Biden liberal electric car money and I sent it back to the president to hire more ICE agents to protect our border.
Yeah.
And they're getting a standing ovation at the Republican state convention.
I want to ask you that. Like, where are governors at on this? Like, you talked about Congress is in kind of do nothing mode, but I cannot imagine that the governor of Georgia is thrilled that like the investments from Rivian or Hyundai Motor Group might get torpedoed here, or if you're in North Carolina, like where are they at on any of this?
Well, it's one of the problems of being a grown-up Republican in the Trump era. The governor of Georgia is a very smart guy, Brian Kemp.
Yeah.
He loves it's the biggest thing since the cotton gin to get all these high-paying assembly plants down there. But he's had trouble with Trump in the past. And he's thinking, you got to look at politicians like brand managers. So he's thinking, what's next for me? Well, I want to run for the U.S. Senate in 2 years against Ossoff, the Democrat. That'll be a big, tough race. Last thing I need is Trump to come down and get some guy in an Uncle Sam suit to primary me. So I've got to use my favorite Russian proverb. I got to figure out how to wash the bear without getting his fur wet. So if I come out and say, don't take my plan away, then Trump's going to be, who's this? That son of a bitch. It's that same guy in Georgia who made all the trouble for me in 18. I'm going to teach him a lesson. Hey, Congressman Bozo, I need you to run. So it's tricky. So a lot of them privately are like, oh, God, how do we save the plant? So when I tell him we're going to go text a million people and rattle the job thing, he's like, well, I have not had this conversation, but I know enough politicians now. I would go say, fantastic, but, you know, deny you ever talked to me. So publicly, they're going to be very quiet and timid because they're afraid of their primary voters. They're afraid of president. And the problem is because we marketed these things as clean air mobiles for so long, EVs have a lot of baggage with rank and file Republican voters. We asked people on a Republican-only survey we did, if your local Republican brought more jobs here, would you be more or less likely to do it? And more people said less likely than more.
Less likely than more to
buy. I'll be more likely to vote against them if they bring EV jobs here. Yeah. Now, don't underestimate the hostility in the Republican drive for EVs.
Wow.
Now, when we pound them about China, it gets better. But you got to do a lot of work. And you got to create this China thing, which nobody knows about. Everybody in the car business does great. Nobody in the electorate knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting how, like, I think we in the, who follow this stuff closely have been taking it as a given that, you know, of course a congressman wouldn't vote against, you know, their own constituents who are getting these jobs. But it sounds like, I mean, the problem is that people aren't really aware of the progress that's been made. And also, even if they are, they're still likely to not even want the jobs because they are
They're a retired 70-year-old Republican who doesn't care about other people not getting the jobs because the average member of Congress is trying to survive the voters. Because the voters of either party basically are give me more stuff and punish people I don't like, which is why tax cuts are popular, spending cuts are not. So privately, they're like, how can I get through this minefield and save the plant? Because they'd like to build. Congressmen love to put on a hard hat and cut a big red ribbon. But on the other hand, they don't want a primary, and they don't want the tribe to burn them alive because they want to be there next year, and it was hard to get there. And they will. That's why you see all the, let's just say it's not Anzio Beach-level courage right now in the Congress, because to thy own career be true. And we're in an era now where EVs are politically costly to be for in the Republican Party. Now, our big focus, and we fought this fight and lost it in the presidential election because we couldn't get any funding, and I couldn't get the Harris campaign to ever wake up. But we've been trying to push this away from a green vehicle debate and away from climate change, because that battle in the EV space is won. If you like climate change, you like EVs. I always joke, you don't need Bubba to put a Save the Whales sticker on the pickup next to the NRA sticker. You just need to put them I always wanted a web ad with Stone Cold Steve Austin in a drag race in a Silverado EV blowing away, you know, some guy in a Volvo. Make it culturally friendly. But we're trying to move the whole debate to the vehicle and the jobs and the lookout, China's coming. And those, with Republicans in our polling, those work. But, you know, it's, and the industry, God bless them, they're slow to move.
Yeah.
They don't like politics, and most of their marketing people are way behind the market.
We talk about this a lot. They don't know how to market these vehicles. It's like you can't bank on fuel efficiency because then that makes your gas cars look bad. Your gas cars, it's where all your profits come from. And Tim and I report on this a lot. We call it entrenchment. It's like if you're any of these automakers, you're You're used to people just showing up at the dealership on Saturday and buying whatever you have. It's like they're not good at making a case for this is why you should do this different thing that is different than what you've always had. Like they are not good at thinking about that.
Yeah, and the dealers, not all of them, but I know a dealer here in LA County. If you can't sell EVs in LA County, you know, and I mean, if a magic hobo came to me, Mike, I will grant you one wish. It would be give me a Kia or a Hyundai dealership in LA County. Or really anywhere in America now. But anyway, if you can't sell them here, but the way cars are sold now, the old problem used to be sleazy salesmen. So how do they clean that up? Well, big corporate ownership groups, the internet to monitor behavior, sell more stuff. Because now that there's price transparency with the internet, it's not like the old days where nobody knew what a car cost. So they changed the incentive system. Every time you buy or lease a car, the last thing you hear from the salesman, oh, hey, you look great in that car. Now, remember, in 2 weeks, you're going to get a letter, and it's going to ask you how I did. My kids are hungry. Please give me 5 stars. And if you have any problems, here's my card. Here's my home number. Call me. Why? Well, their compensation is tied to their ratings on that. And so if somebody comes in and wants a pickup truck at the Chevy dealership and says, I'm interested in these electric things, you're the salesman. You say, well, I can sell them an electric vehicle, and I can say there's $7,500 cash on the hood from Uncle Sam. But 2 weeks from now, when they don't have the home charger put in yet, and they're in the Walmart parking lot in Burbank for 3 hours waiting for rideshare drivers to charge, and they're pissed as shit, and they get the letter the next day and give me 1 star, there goes 40% or whatever of my comp. Why should I take the risk? I mean, Ford, thanks to Farley, I think, and others that are innovative, they solved this. 11 days later, in most cases, Ford will put the charge in your garage. Every company ought to do that. Because now, we're looking in our work at doing a lot of research. The dealer floor is a problem in a lot of places for EVs. And then you got the dealer who doesn't want to put in the hoist that, for the heavy batteries, has now insurance problems. Because if you take the batteries out, you got to put them in a blockhouse somewhere. You lose the insurance for the bill. And I made this point in the meeting today. So Charlie Congressman at the barbecue for the Dallas County Republican Party, or let's make it a smaller place, a Scranton, Pennsylvania GOP meeting, his friend, the dealer, he's been with him 20 years, walks up and says, oh, you're going to get rid of these subsidies? I hate these goddamn EVs. I sell 2 a week. They're a huge headache. So the congressman think, I got a free pass on this. Even the dealers don't like them. So, and dealers are politically powerful. So anyway, we have a lot of work to do. The good news is it's a better product. And the number one thing we find in our surveys is we ask people this fundamental question. Do you or any of your friends or, excuse me, not you, do your friends or relatives have an EV? If they say yes, I don't care if they're Republican, communist, whatever they are, on every EV question, they run 10 to 20 points higher. It's all word of mouth. I tell every dealer, get 10 of them, burn them up. Give them away for weekends, not for an hour test drive, weekends. And, have a phone number they can call on the weekend to get any charging help. And then you're going to move the units. I would cut regular advertising to pay for that because our data screams this. Word of mouth sells EVs. They're a better product. So EVs are going to win in the end. But if the government gets in the way, it's worth $1 trillion to the Chinese. That's the bottom line.
I got family down in Deep Red, Texas, and it's just like, around these things, I tell them what it's like. It's like, okay, I get it. It's a car. Some things are different. Some things are better. Some things are kind of annoying right now. It's progress. Like people get it when they have experience with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, basically we divide people into base, swing base, like politics. And on EVs, there are about 20% who are pretty gung-ho. They tend to be younger. Another good thing EVs have is over time, young people become all people and all consumers. So you got the 20% that are kind of there. Then you got another 35% to say, no way, screw you, never going to have an EV. That tends to be more Republican, tends to be older, more rural. And then you got the middle, the 40%, it would say this about themselves. I'm going to consider an EV seriously once they get the bugs worked out and the prices are a little bit lower.
Sure.
I mean, that tells you right totally there. Yeah, completely fair. So 2/3 of the market is in play, but got to get good at charging. And by the way, I'm a fanatic on this. The problem is not fast charging. I've driven a Volkswagen ID.4 across the country from L.A. to Boston 3 times in the last 18 months, kind of for the experience. And I had no real problems till I got to New Hampshire. And luckily, I was meeting the governor the next day, so the poor guy had to listen to 90 minutes. And another reason this state sucks. he kept telling me nobody in New Hampshire wants EVs. And I said, well, I dare you to go to the broken EV station there on the Vermont border where one charger was working. There was a line of 11 cars, and they were all tourists from Quebec or Massachusetts streaming, both high EV adoption areas. So, Governor, if you believe in tourist money, you know. But anyway, my point being, it's level two in multifamily buildings. That is the key. And it won't happen with little tax credits. We got to take NEVI money or state money, and we got to drop them in. And it's a pretty good political deal. I mean, I've worked for a lot of governors. If I go to governor and say, Governor, we want to put in 30,000 level two charging spots in apartment buildings for free. He'll be, oh, giveaway. What are you talking about? Governor, let me rephrase it. We want to put in 30,000 level two parking for free to the apartment owners so they can charge $20 a month for it and keep the money. We can have union electricians, so you're up for re-election, install them. We can have the environmental community love it. And you're a Republican. Remember that coal mine we opened last year? And you can, for rideshare drivers, give them $500 a month effective raise. When do we start? Because the political coalition to do it is really good, and you get a lot more bang for your buck. It's all over our polling. Are you considering an EV, but you don't think you can have one because you live in an apartment or condo? It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And in the rideshare world, if you're a rideshare person, you know, you have the free charging for a while, but you're in that Walmart parking lot for 3 hours a day charging twice. If you could charge overnight in your apartment, and more than half the rideshare drivers in California are in apartments, for 19 cents a kilowatt at night, rather than pay 51 or 48 or 55 at the fast charging station, it's a meaningful raise. So there's a political win here for the level two in the apartment buildings, but you got to let the multifamily owner get it for free because they're grinders. They're just not going to pay, but you can do it for a couple grand a spot, and you can get some money from the utilities to offset it. Not enough, but something. So anyway, it's a target rich environment for political progress, I would say. And I really enjoy working in it.
You do seem optimistic despite the headwinds. And I mean, you outlined a pretty tough case for what, again, a lot of people are mad about, like the fuel that goes into their car now. But like, you do seem like it's going to win out in the end, right?
Better product wins.
Yeah.
And, you know, it will not be the end of the world if we're all driving great Chinese EVs that cost $27,000 a year. But it'll break my heart as somebody who's in the middle class because of the auto industry.
Yeah.
And it'll break the Pentagon's heart. So it'll be a disaster for America, but they're coming. And, you know, the country decided to punish the incumbent president. I get that. And elect somebody who's overtly hostile to EVs. So, you know, we might be able to curb some of the damage, but we're going to have a little stormy weather for a while here. But in the end, the better product does tend to win. I'm just hoping it's a North American manufactured better product. And that, I think, is in question.
Mike Murphy, thanks for joining us today. It's been excellent.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much.
Some great insights there from Mike. All right, Tim, now it's time for Plus Minus, that part of the show where we talk about who's up or who's down this week. Tim, who you got for me, man?
I have a plus this week, and it is the Volkswagen ID.4. This is VW's electric crossover that did not have a great 2024. It had a recall, a stop sale that kept it off of dealer lots for months, or I guess I should say kept it on dealer lots out of customer hands. But they're bouncing back from that. And last month in January, Volkswagen sold 5,000 Volkswagen ID.4s in the U.S., which is huge. That made it the third best-selling EV in America. And at an annualized rate, that's what, 60,000 ID.4s this year. I don't know if they'll actually keep that up because this is probably a lot of like pent up demand.
Yeah.
But big deal, good bounce back for Volkswagen. And I think one of the reasons that they've been able to sell so many of them is this crazy lease deal that Suvrat found, which is that now you can lease one for $189 per month for 24 months with $999 due at signing, which is like, I mean, they're basically giving these things away. So you're stealing
that car from Volkswagen. Like you're committing like felony theft if you find a deal like that. That's the deals are insane on those things. I like the ID.4. I think you got to get the nicer trims to really, really get the benefit of it, because some of the lesser ones are kind of whatever. But like, you know, a nicely equipped ID4 is a very good EV right now. They've ironed out a lot of the issues that the early cars had. I've enjoyed everyone I've ever driven. So like, if you're shopping for a new car crossover, like, do yourself a favor and look at the ID4, because you might be able to get one just by telling like the salesperson he looks nice that day, you know, or asking if he got like a haircut or something. It's they're giving them away, Tim. It's crazy. Giving them away.
Yeah, I like that thing too. A lot of people have big problems with them. Our deputy editor, Mac, does not like the ID4 at all. I think it's a decent car. Like, I see tons of them out here. And people in the Bay Area can choose from a lot of different EVs. So that bodes well.
Plus, Mac doesn't like anything, as I often remind him. Mine this week is unfortunately a minus, and you know, it brings me no pleasure to put Tesla in this column, but like, these anti-Tesla, anti-Elon protests are heating up. They're not going anywhere. There were thousands of demonstrations this past weekend from Portland to London. There are a bunch more planned for the US this weekend in Europe. There's like a whole website where people are organizing them. And it is hurting the company. The stock price is down. As you pointed out before the call, I'll cite my source here, which is Tim Levin. Stock price is down 19% in the past 5 days alone. It's down 25% in the last month. We don't know what their sales are like. They don't report those until their Q1 numbers are finalized. So we're not going to know what that was like until April. But if this keeps up, like the kind of backlash against Elon Musk that's... I don't need to explain why. Just read any newspaper and you might see there's a very real chance this is going to come back to like bite this company in the ass hard this year. And I don't know to what point it gets where the Tesla board removes him, if that's even an option at all, or if that would just so utterly decimate the stock price that it's never in consideration. But like, this is, I think we're getting to perhaps the biggest moment of crisis this company has ever faced, and by late March and early April we're gonna know what that looks like for them. So not great, Tim. Not what you want.
Yeah, I think if this was any kind of normal company, the board would have already stepped in and asked the CEO to step aside. This is not a normal company. Musk owns a ton of Tesla stock. He's seen as the guy, the reason that it's worth so much. He's put a lot of money in all those people's pockets. I remember recently that the chair of the board, Robin Denholm, sold a ton of Tesla stock. She has made millions, tens of millions, maybe over $100 million on Tesla stock. So you can see why there's a hesitance to like bring the hammer down on Elon. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. We've been talking about this for a while and it's really only gotten worse every week.
Yeah, this is a trend we've been watching for a while at Inside EVs, like just the decline in Tesla sales, a lot because it was linked to the CEO, the demonstrations are new. I mean, this is breaking into mainstream news. Like, I'm seeing this on the New York Times, Bloomberg's reporting on it, CNN's reporting on it. Like, this is not just some, like, you know, thing that's known in you know, the automotive industry. It's becoming, like, a thing, and we'll see what comes of it, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, I also think that, just to add one thing, there's been a lot of stories about Tesla sales dropping really hard across Europe, which is valid and fair. I think that part of that is also due to the fact that they're launching a new Model Y, which means there has to be a little bit of a pause in production as they ramp down the old one, ramp up the new one. So, you know, there's a little bit of nuance there, but
yeah, I
think
it's
fair to say that Tesla is feeling the heat.
Yeah, and it's like, if you're considering buying a Model Y, the best-selling EV, best-selling car in the world, like, you'd probably behoove you to wait for the new one, because there's a lot of improvements they seem to have made for it. So that's going to be the X factor this year, I think, right? I do believe that's the ultimate referendum on Musk specifically. But it's not out yet. It's going to be out in March, especially pretty much everywhere. So we'll see how that shakes out, man.
Yeah, the more times you mention that as being the referendum on Tesla, the better chance there is that Elon Musk just goes out and buys like a million of them next week, just to juice the sales. We'll see.
It becomes the only government fleet vehicle that anyone is allowed to buy. Like all the FBI cars, it's just gonna be that or the Cybertruck. You know, it's just
mail trucks, Model Y mail trucks,
Model Y mail trucks. Yeah, they care of our emissions problems. You know, we'll see. All right, thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday as always. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network.
Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, leave us a review, and tell a friend to tune in. It'll really help us out. And if you liked what you heard, you can find all our EV coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next week.
Thanks, all.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.